Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and happy to be with you again tonight. Last week, I had a lively discussion with Dr. Wilhelm Christman about the background and reasons for Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941, under the overall heading of Who Started World War II. At the end of the program, we only touched on the Hess flights to Scotland in May of 1941. Tonight, I intended to have Dr. Christman here again, but something came up unexpectedly, so I'm going to carry on my own here about all this background of who is responsible for what all these things that were occurring, and who is responsible for prolonging the war and causing it to be more vicious and brutal than possibly it needed to be. A listener named Al Person wrote to me some time back, and he sent me an item which was written by the author. The item was about a book titled Hess, the British Conspiracy. It's by John Harris and Mia Trow, and it came out in 1999, and he asked me to discuss the general outline of this book, or the general thrust of this book, on the program. So I'm going to mention this book and quite a few other sources about the Hess peace mission to Scotland in 1941, and whatever other issues come up that we would go into from that. So I'm going to start out just to get this book out of the way, because I didn't think too much of it. But I didn't read the book, of course. I read the man's review, and I looked at the book on Amazon, which it didn't have any reviews there, and it's already been discounted in price, so I don't think it's been taken too seriously. But it posits an idea that is very popular in circles, particularly those who are looking for conspiracies. And believe me, I am not against conspiracies. I believe in lots of conspiracies. There's just some people are more open and willing to believe in certain conspiracies because they fit with their overall beliefs, and that's how we all operate, I think. But in this one, the book posits that a key participation in the whole Hess mystery was the Polish General Sikorsky, who has been, other people talked about him to me before when I was talking about Poland. General Sikorsky was head of the Polish government in exile, and he died in a mysterious plane crash off Gibraltar later in the war. And so many want to say that he was murdered by the British government because they were unhappy with him for a number of reasons. Be that as it may, there is no real proof that has ever come up yet that the British government was involved in that plane crash or that it was caused by enemies of Sikorsky. But the reasons that the author of this book, The British Conspiracy about Hess, gives for Sikorsky's key role, as I said, are not convincing to me. Mostly it's that Sikorsky was in the area shortly after Hess's arrival, but he was not in the exact place, and he did not have a meeting with Hess or his captors. There's no evidence, and no one is saying that he talked to any of these people. He spent the day in Glasgow on the day of May 11th, the day of Hess's flight. But they put meaning, and then the fact that he died in this plane crash. And also, these authors say that they involve Sikorsky because they make this rather dishonest statement, I think, in his review. And I'm going to quote it. He says, "But why involve Sikorsky? Question. In order to obtain a peace, it is likely that one of the principal terms of an armistice would have had to be a withdrawal of German troops from Poland France, and the Low Countries. Sikorsky would have had a vital role to play in any such negotiations, unquote. Well, but a withdrawal from Poland was not one of the terms of the proposal. Yes, the proposals Hitler was presenting were a withdrawal from France and the Low Countries, withdrawal from Europe, but not withdrawal from Poland. And so if he doesn't in this review give any evidence of where he gets that from, I suppose he has more about it in the book. But I'd have to write that off for that reason. And he also puts meaning on the fact that the Duke of Kent was killed in a mysterious plane crash during the war, and that the Duke of Kent was the king's younger brother, and that the Duke of Kent was among those considered friendly by the Germans, and they had hopes for him helping to broker a peace agreement. But the Duke of Kent was really not saying anything, and so there's no evidence that he was participating in any of that. Duke of Hamilton, yes. So we'll get into that. So that's, Al, is what I think about those particular authors and that particular explanation. Now, to give some background on the Hess flight to Scotland, it's known that the German government, both through their intelligence organizations and through the Foreign Office and through other means, were continually searching, you might say, putting out feelers for agreement for an armistice between Germany and Britain. It's clear that we don't need to repeat again and again that Hitler did not want this war. He did not want war with Britain. He had no interest in taking over Western Europe. His interest was always in the East. He was trying to gain the territory he had lost there and also gain some other territory, possibly. But that was probably when he went into Poland and solved that problem, that was probably what he would have been settled with for quite a while. But other forces were working against Germany and had been even before that. So he had a lot of things to deal with here. So, but he was trying to get this peace in the West, and Hess was apparently extremely upset when Britain declared war on Germany. Now, I want to tell you that, in case you don't know, Rudolf Hess was born in Egypt, and his father was a merchant, and they lived in British-run Egypt until he was 14 years old. That's pretty old, before he ever moved to Germany. So all that time, he was living among the British, and he felt that he knew the British. He spoke English very well, and he felt very friendly with the British. He knew a lot of British that were friendly with the Germans in Germany. And one of them that he was had a good relationship with was the Duke of Hamilton, who had his estate in Scotland. And there were a lot of German-friendly individuals and groups in Britain. But the fact is that once the war was declared and once some bombing started taking place and so on, that feelings hardened, and these German-friendly groups, they had no power, and they were not influential, and they may not even have really existed anymore as a group. So it was just some individuals who were just sorry. They were just sorry to see this battle between Britain and Germany, just like Germans were sorry to see it. But Hess was under the influence, or had a professor when he was at the University of Munich, named Karl Haushofer. And Karl Haushofer was the originator of the study of geopolitics, and he had a lot of ideas about how this worked, and he was an expert on Britain. And he had a son named Albrecht, who he brought up in all of this, and Albrecht was very well educated. He was an expert on Britain. He spoke absolutely fluent English, and he understood the English, and he was called into the service of Rudolf Hess by Hess, and they together, Hess was seeking advice on how to approach the British. He thought that because their previous approaches had been rebuffed, that maybe there was something wrong in the way they were doing it, maybe they weren't wording things correctly, and this Albrecht Haushofer agreed with that. He said they weren't, and they weren't doing it right. And Hess was trying to learn from him, and Haushofer was advising him. And Haushofer was a good man. He knew what he was doing, and he gave good advice. And Hess brought him to Hitler. I mean, didn't bring him physically, but at first, but he, you know, approached Hitler with all this. And, you know, Hess's position was as deputy Führer at that time, and it was kind of mostly ceremonial. Hess was not really in charge of anything except just it's deputy Führer to Hitler and carrying out a lot of duties and signing things and doing a lot of stuff to take the load off of Adolf Hitler. And in fact, once Hess was out of the picture, that position was filled by Martin Bormann. That was Martin Bormann's title, but he had actually expanded duties from what Hess had. But anyway, that was Hess's position. So he had time to work on things of his own, and he was working on this. And he brought this to Hitler's attention. Well, my question, and I wish I had Dr. Christmy here to give his opinion on this, but I think it's odd that Hitler, Hess, and Haushofer, those three, singly were, by 1941, advancing some very top-secret proposals through Haushofer to certain British diplomats, and, well, not very many of them, one or two, and individuals, without the advice and help of their intelligence services and so on, because they had been doing this, but none of this had worked. And it may be that Hitler believed that they had failed and that it was worth giving Hess's ideas a try through Haushofer. I mean, he really had nothing to lose. He could trust Hess, and he felt after meeting Haushofer and through what he had done so far, he could trust Haushofer. So it appears in this scenario that no one beyond Hitler, Hess, and Haushofer knew of these particular feelers that Hess and Haushofer were involved in. But I don't think they could have been doing this without Hitler's knowledge. But where I come to the end of where I think Hitler was involved, I'll say as I get later on. But at this time now, we have, I'm kind of jumping ahead of all that was done to come to the time when we just have these three approaching, in particular, a man named Samuel Hoare. And Samuel Hoare was British ambassador to Spain. But he was also a part of the Secret Intelligence Service. And they also felt that the Germans felt that Halifax was on their side, or could be on their side. And Halifax had been pro-German, Lord Halifax, who had been foreign secretary, but he was replaced when the ambassador to America, to the United States, died. They sent Winston Churchill, replaced him with Halifax. And because it was considered in Britain that Halifax, and considered everywhere, that Halifax, he had been a Chamberlain supporter, and he was not fully supportive of Churchill, that he was not really on board with the way Churchill was running the war, that he kind of banished him to as ambassador to America. But that's a very important post, so that wasn't the case. But they nurtured that impression about Halifax, where in truth Halifax was totally on board with Churchill, as was all of them, as Sam Hoare was also considered one of these that wasn't, and he was an ambassador to Spain, but he also had come fully on board, because it's like we know when the going gets tough, when the war really gets going, everybody rallies around the flag. I mean, they don't, well, except in Germany. In Germany, you had real traitors, but you didn't find these real traitors in Britain. So there were some meetings. There were definitely, I've got so many sources, but okay, I'm going to break in here and say that there was an explanation of the Hess flight written in 1943 by an anonymous source that was printed in the American Mercury magazine. And that is published on the IHR website. You can find that there. And many people say, including Mark Weber in his introduction, that this is the most convincing account and probably true and so on. And it sounds very good when you read it. But being that it appeared in 1943 when the war was going on, and is definitely written by a British, it's definitely from British sources, it's pretty hard to believe or to think it's the real truth. And after reading Martin Allen's book, The Hitler Hess Deception, which I'm going to base the majority of my own sense of how this worked on, because his book has so much more detail. He's one of those establishment historians that I don't trust. But when this book came out, it was quite a sensation. And his book came out in 2003, 4 years late after this British conspiracy book by these two authors, which I said I didn't think much of, although I didn't read it. But no, I don't think anybody thinks much of it, though. But Hitler Hess Deception was really taken seriously. But it has since, this is the one that it has since come out, that he has been charged with, and this man has died, Allen has died in the meantime, but he was charged with forging some of the documents that he used to develop his thesis in this book. And when he was at the archives, the British archives, and, you know, had the files in his possession there and looking through them and taking notes and so on, that he inserted these forged documents that he had brought. And then he said, well, he discovered these documents in there and this that nobody had noticed before or something. And now he, you know, was using them. Well, according to the archivists, it's pretty hard to deny that they say they didn't have these things listed before. And he was the last person to look in there, and then they found, then these were there. So that's pretty strong evidence. But at the same time, we don't know, or I don't know, what documents these were. They weren't all the documents. And he has, everything that he says here is not just depending on documents. And I think he's not just depending on documents either. So that doesn't necessarily refute what he's telling us in this book, because he's got a tremendous amount of information, a lot of which is definitely not forged. You know it isn't. And so he may have added some things to make his case stronger or more interesting. So that's what I wanted to let you know that. But this American Mercury article was one that is commonly read. And there was another one that is called From Myths and Legends of the Second World War by James Hayward, which I read yesterday. And I found it very good. A lot of good stuff in it. And I was going to talk from that. And I have it all here. And there's some parts of it that I disagree with. And I've got it listed, I've got those, my disagreements. But since that, I have also gone through the Martin Allen book and taken notes, and I'm quite impressed with the way this pans out here, and this is where my clarity came from, which I'm going to reveal to you shortly. I think I'm going to go through my notes on Martin Allen first, and then I can go back to some of this other, because I feel that this is the best compilation of the whole affair of all that I've looked at. So I will say that the elder Karl Haushofer, who was Rudolf Hess's teacher, in 1945, he was arrested by the British. Well, they didn't arrest him. They came and they found him. He had a home way in the Black Forest, and he was staying there quietly with his wife. An elderly man by now, he is the father of Albrecht Haushofer, who was the one who was really involved in these meetings. Albrecht was found by the British Secret Service. They were scouring Germany, so was the U.S. intelligence forces, and scouring the area to find out and look for evidence that they wanted to destroy. Really, that's what they're... A large part of what they were looking for, stuff that they wanted to get rid of that was going to be evidence they didn't of what they were doing and things they were up to that they didn't want to be in the history. As a matter of fact, I don't want to miss saying that there was a mysterious fire in the office of the British intelligence 1945, the SOE, that destroyed 85% of their documents. Very odd, huh? So they really didn't want any of this to come out. But anyway, Carl Haushofer, in his interrogation, he said, he made this statement, "My son, Albrecht, was sent to Switzerland in 1941. This is what he knew. He says, this is what I know about it. And he met a confidential agent by the name of Lord Templewood. Hitler offered to relinquish Norway, Denmark, and France. When Albrecht returned, he was called to Augsburg." That's where Hess was stationed most of the time. "Augsburg to see Hess. A few days later, Hess flew to England." And Lord Templewood is, the name is actually Sam Hoare, who figures prominently in all of this. So that's the beginning of what Haushofer told, you know, under fear of God knows what. The elderly Haushofers were not arrested by these two British intelligence agents who interviewed them, but 2 days later they were found by another son of theirs deep in the woods near their home in that Bavarian forest, dead. Mrs. Haushofer was hanging from a tree, and Carl Haushofer was sitting bent over, hunched over in a hollow. It was determined by autopsy that Carl had died from cyanide poisoning. Well, that's what Martin Allen says. And the lights were on in their house, and the house was deserted. Nobody had stolen anything. Nobody had taken anything. These two British intelligence agents were the last known to have seen them alive, but nobody seems to think that they were responsible for this. So to say a little bit about how British intelligence was set up at this time, we have the SOE under the Foreign Office, from which the SO1 became an independent unit. SO1 was an even deeper, more secretive ops than the SOE, and it included things like whispers, which worked to create feelings that incompetence and even lunacy existed in Nazi hierarchy, and was disseminated in Germany. And the SO1 developed a plan to engage German leadership in bogus peace negotiations. This came from the fact that they knew they were studying the psychology of Hitler, and they knew that he was very interested in peace. So they thought they would use that and play on that. Now Rex Lieber is an important player in this. He was the head of the SO1, and he was a friend of Churchill, and was in the Foreign Office Political Intelligence Department before he was made head of SO1. And he became also, while there, close to permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office, Robert Vansittart, a well-known German hater, along with Churchill and this Rex Lieber, too. And also known, he's known as Lord Vansittart. So many of these men had titles of this nature. Their plan was to bring together Churchill, Vansittart, the whole Foreign Office plan, was to bring together opponents of Nazism under the campaign, which they used, of Nazi Germany is the enemy of civilization. Now, Lieber felt that every means at his disposal was sanctioned to hit back at Germany after Dunkirk. And this phony peace operation officially did not exist, there was no name for it, and it was never consigned to paper. So we will learn more about this and conclude all of this, what I think is the best story of what actually happened and what Hess's flight was all about after the break.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Angry protests have taken place in Tel Aviv against the planned deportation of 400 children of immigrant workers born in Israel. And speaking Hebrew, the youngsters were never given citizenship because their parents are not Israeli or Jewish. And as RT's Paulus Lear reports, many people are questioning the government's drive to preserve what it calls the Jewish character of the state.
He's 5,500 miles away from most of his family, living in a country where his mother's unemployed and frightened, and now they're about to be deported. But this is the only world 4-year-old John Michael knows. Born in Israel, he speaks Hebrew, his friends are Israeli, and he understands precious little about the place he's about to be sent to, the very place his mother came from, the Philippines. She asks us not to name her.
He learned, he speaks with their language, he knows their food, their friends. I asked him one time, JM, you like to go to Philippines? Philippines? Efo? Where's Philippines? Of course, he don't know the place. In my country, where my papa is. And he said, okay, Ima, I'll go to Philippines with my friends. As how can I explain to him?
It was a journey that started with so much hope. John Michael's mom, like 40,000 other Filipinos, was lured with the dream of work and a new life in the promised land. But soon after she became pregnant, she was fired and her visa cancelled. For months now, Israelis have been torn over what to do about the future of hundreds of children who, like John Michael, are born and bred in Israel, but who are not considered Israeli citizens. Most of the children's parents arrived in Israel in the early 90s. They replaced cheap Palestinian labor that was becoming harder for Israelis to access. Curfews and roadblocks had made it difficult for Palestinians to get permits to work in Israel. Which is why today, as many as 500,000 foreign workers live in Israel, earning much more than they would back home. But the payoff is the uncertainty that now clouds their children's future.
The Interior Ministry says it has to deport these children because there are already so many illegals in this country. It says they threaten the Jewish character of the state. But it's a controversial decision that has many asking why children should have to pay the price for the government's lack of a clear policy.
And the anger of many has spilled over onto the streets. After months of thinking it over, the Israeli government now says it will deport 400 foreign children and their families who do not match strict criteria that would have allowed them to stay in Israel. These include living in Israel for 5 years, being part of the school system, and having parents with valid work permits.
The holiday is over. They make 10 times more money here than they do in other countries, like Romania, for example. Enough with this hypocrisy. Will any of these children rise up and cry? Stop talking rubbish. They will return to their families. That's where they need to be.
The protesters say it's by expelling children that the very character of the Jewish state is threatened.
For me personally, it's knowing these children, working with them already for 3 years, seeing them and understanding that they're not only Israeli, they're the best Israeli, because they love this country, they just want to contribute and be a part of us. So I really can't understand how anyone that really knows them can stand aside and let them be deported from their homeland.
It's very, very important that the democratic part of Israeli public opinion will make its voice very loud and very clear and press the politicians to make the right decision.
Israeli law says that every Jew around the world has the right to Israeli citizenship. But for John Michael, who's Israeli in every sense of the word, just not his faith, that citizenship is a distant reality. He's one of the 400 children threatened with deportation. Paul Isfier, RT, Tel Aviv.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Continuing with my story about the Hess flight, and this is taken mostly from the Martin Allen book, which I did read about a year ago or so, and I found it very interesting. And it convinced me, as it does when you read something new, you know, he's very convincing, and it convinced me of what he was presenting. And then later, as I talked to other people and as time went on, I started doubting a lot of things again. And I would still say that whether Adolf Hitler knew of Hess's flight is not known and may never be known, because we don't know that all that much will be revealed when these archives open in 2017, because they have destroyed a lot of things that they want to have destroyed. But anyway, to continue on with what I think is important about this, these are my highlights that I think are worth talking about today, and that is that on Saturday, May 10th, 1941, that was the day of Hess's final flight to Scotland. There was a meeting at Woburn Abbey, and it included Anthony Eden, who is now the Foreign Secretary, Hugh Dalton, who was head of the overall intelligence of the Foreign Office, Rex Leeper, who I've already talked about, and 18 others. And their minutes were taken of this meeting, and they were at Woburn Abbey. Now, they took some minutes, actually, and the objective at their meeting says this. Now, maybe these were some of the things that Alan forged, but I don't know. According to the minutes, their objective was to encourage the Germans to attack Russia by misleading Hitler and by hinting that the large sections in both Britain and the United States who preferred the overthrow of the Russian regime rather than the German regime might be prepared to force through a compromise peace between Britain and Germany and those two nations combined to destroy the common enemy, communism. Now, this is what they wanted to encourage the Germans to believe in this campaign of theirs. So, on that same day, Hess arrived, but afterwards, Britain did not want to be seen to have encouraged any peace talks, either real or phony intelligence, run. Both were harmful to their image. I mean, they disavowed that. But these men were there to meet this emissary pretending to be the interested parties. I'm sure Anthony Eden was not going to be presenting himself and any of these guys, but some people were going to be there to see who had come and to give him some kind of an idea. And they were expecting a man named Hugh Boley. But to that in a moment. These two allies, Britain and Russia, were both secretly, supposedly, trying to get Germany to attack the other one. Well, it wasn't much of a secret to astute people that Britain would have been happy for Germany to attack Russia or Russia to attack Germany and vice versa for Russia. That was both of their goals, and yet they were allies. Now, the peace offer, though, from Germany was real. But as I already said, Churchill didn't want anybody to know about it. He certainly didn't want France or Belgium or the Netherlands or Norway or any of the countries that were currently occupied by Germany to know that Germany was offering to relinquish its control on those nations and to leave and to maybe keep a minimal kind of police force there, but otherwise to end their occupation. So these countries were not advised of this, and Churchill did not want them to be advised, and he didn't want them to know anything about this, but they were keeping this facade up for reasons of causing Hitler to feel safe enough to invade the Soviet Union. Now, Churchill was very much afraid that Germany was going to head south into Africa and into the Middle East, into their oil sources, and take over. Britain was very weak at this time, probably at its weakest point, and Hitler seemed to be quite strong. Although it was known that there was economic problems for Germany in getting enough resources for their to carry on with the war. Oil was crucial for everyone, and certainly Russia had plenty of it. Soviet Union had plenty of it for themselves, but Britain had to protect its sources, and the main sources that Germany had at the time were in Romania. So they were very worried that Germany was going to go in that direction, and they were very worried that Germany was going to go further into the Caucasus and take over large oil reserves and oil sources there. Churchill wanted Hitler to make a frontal assault on the Soviet Union, which is what Hitler decided to do, and we talked about that last week. How intelligent that was is up for question, but how it worked out, according to Suvorov's book, is what we talked about. Now, to get back to the story, Sam Hoare, who was Britain's ambassador to Spain, it was a key person that the Germans were talking to, and Rudolf Hess, it's known that both made secret trips on Saturday, the 21st of December, 1940, to Switzerland. or to somewhere. No, they think it's Switzerland. They both made trips somewhere on that day. It makes a great deal of sense that Sam Hoar, because of the way his trip was described, that he was going to fly over a belligerent country to get to a neutral country. His trip was 2 days, Friday and Saturday. He was coming from Spain. And that would make sense that he was flying over France to get to Switzerland. Hess made a shorter trip on Saturday, and it could very easily have gone to Switzerland and back in the time that he was gone. Now, the peace faction by the Germans was seen as to be hoping to be led by Lord Halifax and Sam Hoar. Once they got communication properly going with those two, that's who they were depending on to rally it or be behind it or get it going and to be the ones who would take over, especially Lord Halifax, from Churchill. The idea was that if they could out Churchill, if they could get a vote of no confidence for Churchill, and then they would have the support of the Duke of Kent, which is King George's brother, to form a new government, and that new government would be led by Halifax. And then Halifax would eventually, in a short time, say, well, this war is not working out very well, and decide that they should get an armistice. They should agree to an armistice with Germany. That was the idea. Now, what actually happened was that the British had no intention of doing that, but the Germans thought that they might. Now, on February 28, 1941, this Hugh Dalton, who was the head of SOE, appeared to have a conscience about this, and he revealed something very interesting about just the level of wrongdoing that Britain was engaged in here. It wasn't at all something they had a right to do, because Hugh Dalton himself, head of this of their security agencies and a big intelligence operative himself, he wrote to Anthony Eden. This was February 1941, who was then Foreign Secretary, and this is a document that's authentic. He wrote, after discussing with Prime Minister, which was Churchill, but he didn't use Churchill's name, and SO1, he had a meeting with them that day. He said, after discussing with them, that we cannot win a war in Europe, but we could win a world war. He then said, what Winston now proposes is a truly terrible thing that, and I am not sure my conscience will allow me to participate. So from this, it was clear, again, that Britain's long-term strategy was to expand the war into a world war. They could not win a war in Europe against Germany. But if they could bring in allies, and Churchill was always saying he needed allies, if they could bring in allies, the U.S. and or the Soviet Union, in the end they brought in both, then they could win. Or that would be expanding what they had at the moment into an even larger war, a world war. So Dalton sent the same kind of sentiments to Churchill, which Churchill regarded as a weakness on his part, a weakening of resolve, and he was highly annoyed, according to Vansittart, who had been to see Churchill at that time, and he wrote to Rex Leeper, and I quote here too, I have rarely seen Winston so annoyed as when he received H.D.'s letter yesterday. H.D. stands for Hugh Dalton. I would appreciate first-hand news of any problems with H.D., as I believe B.B., who was Brendan Bracken, Churchill's faithful political secretary, as I believe B.B. has given the go-ahead to reduce him, meaning H.D., once the operation has reached its conclusion. Now, Brendan Bracken was called Churchill's faithful chela. He was a red-haired Irishman who was officially Churchill's political private secretary. He was kind of like a Borman, but he was different. He was more politically active. And in later years, well, Hugh Dalton was dismissed and was treated pretty badly, and he called B.B. A force of evil influence upon Churchill. But as a matter of fact, they are both evil. They were evil influences on each other. So now, on March 26, 1941, Sam Hoare was notified that Albrecht Haushofer was in Madrid. So here we have Sam Hoare in Madrid as ambassador to Spain, and suddenly Albrecht Haushofer shows up. Now, he had had talks with Haushofer before. This is not the first one, but Haushofer shows up, so Sam Hoare meets with him, and he asks Hoare why there's no progress from Halifax. And Hoare makes excuses. Haushofer then told Hoare that his superior insisted on a meeting with a close representative of Churchill on neutral territory. Now, Hoare was avoiding naming anyone because it was all a facade and they didn't have anyone. You know, they didn't have anyone appointed to meet with the Germans, but the Germans had someone, and that was this Bolle, and he at that time was the one they thought they would send as their representative. Well, at this point, the British refused a meeting on neutral territory, and they continued to make that a reason that they could not make any progress in this meeting of these two representatives, because they said we won't meet in neutral territory because we don't trust the Nazis and they might kidnap our representative. That was their big excuse. So at that point, it may be that Hess saw the whole affair that he had put so much hope into, fading, because time was going by and the British were making excuses. They really didn't want a meeting. And so Hess set up a meeting whereby the German representative would fly to Scotland to meet there, showing all this trust, showing that they were in good faith, you know, all of these things, which I think a proper Secret Service organization would never go along with. But this was Hess, and Hess, a Haushofer. Now, and they had this Ernst Bolle, who was kind of enthused about it. He was let in on it to a certain degree, but not fully, because he was going to be the representative. And he was quite willing to go. Now, at this point, how much Hitler knew about this further development can be questioned, because I believe that Hitler did not know that Hess was going to go himself. He did not approve of that, and that's why he was so angry about it. But before we get to that, let's talk about here. Hess decided, it may be, I don't know, but here we were kind of at an impasse, and the plan for the invasion of Russia was at hand. And Hess was a very earnest lover of peace and a very, very decent man and a willing man to do everything he could do. And it may be that he had put so much into this and he was unable to accept that it wasn't going to work and that there was no hope. And that he then got the idea that he would go himself. And he would force the issue. And if he went himself, it would carry so much weight, and they wouldn't be able to put him off. They wouldn't be able to, he could look directly in their eyes and so on. And he really believed that they were there, he believed that this was real, that Lord Hamilton was there and all these people were there, but he didn't know what the problems were. Well, this maybe doesn't make any sense. But he did go. So, there has to be some reason why he went. And it may be that Ernst Bolle was scheduled to go, and it may be that Hitler was willing for Ernst Bolle to go, because, again, he didn't have that much to lose. He could find out what these people were up to. At this point, I don't even see why Hitler didn't announce to the world after Hess's flight of what everybody was up to. The British were still trying to keep this quiet, and maybe they had not sent any actual written documents to Germany, to the Germans, probably, these were all just personal face-to-face talks. But in any case, Ernst Bolle did not go, and Hess took off on May 10th. And another question that I have had all along is why there were no lights. Supposedly, he understood there were going to be lights at the Dungavel House and he would be able to land there. This is the Duke of Hamilton's residence. The Duke of Hamilton's residence was where Hess was going, and I'm not sure there was anybody there waiting. But somebody was there. Yeah, somebody was there. Because the lights, when it was time, when Hess flew over, and he overflew the place, but he was right on track, but it had already gotten dark. He couldn't see, you know, he couldn't use any visual clues anymore. And, but he, I think he was right on time, so that's when he intended to get there. But he couldn't possibly land in the dark, and he was looking for the place and wondering why there were no lights. And then there is a story that at the Dungavel house at the time that he was flying over, some ladies who worked there, local women, were leaving the house after working there all day, and they testified later that the airstrip lights went on for a few minutes, and then they went off again. And when they went off again, this aircraft passed over. So they didn't want the lights to go on because the ladies were upset that the lights went on because it was, you know, wartime and they had blackouts. So they said, why are those lights on? But then that's why they noticed it so much. Wow, my gosh, I hope they turn those lights off. And then the lights went off. Then they heard a plane fly over, very loud. And in any case, it may be that Hess made radio contact with the people in the house. And that when he made radio contact, they realized that it was not Bolle, Ernst Bolle, because of his voice and his way of speaking. Ernst Bolle was fluent in English also. Well, so was Hess. But that they thought that if Bolle came, they could talk to him and put him off and whatever. But they couldn't do that with Hess. So now the whole thing was in jeopardy. They were in big trouble. And so they turned the lights off, and Hess ended up crashing the plane and parachuting out. And then, of course, he was found by that farmer, and the farmer took him to the local Scottish police station, and then all these Scottish people were, and he said his name was Alfred Horn, and he was giving this story. He said he was trying to get to Lord Hamilton's estate and see Lord Hamilton. And the whole thing was, it's not laughable, but it became kind of ridiculous. And finally, the intelligence operative showed up, and then they gave a story to the Scottish patriots there. And the Scottish patriots were reluctant to believe them and didn't want to let go of their prisoner that they were so proud of. But eventually they did, and they hustled Hess off. And then he was incommunicado from then on, and they did lots of debriefing and so on. But they wouldn't let him say anything, and they came out with whatever story they came out with and kept everything as quiet as they could. And that was the end of that. Now, Hitler was so, people who know him and the people who were around him said they have never seen him so upset, so angry. They felt it was quite genuine. And there was an order that was sent out once he found out that Hess had taken off in that direction to shoot down his plane. But then he arrested Hess's staff, and they were all questioned. And he arrested quite a few people and questioned them. But he didn't give any permanent punishment to any of these people because it wasn't their fault. You know, Hess had the authority over these people to order them to do things. He was deputy Führer. So in the end, my opinion is that Adolf Hitler was involved in this scheme, or this operation, up to a point, but he did not authorize Rudolf Hess to go on his own, and he wouldn't have, because it just wasn't seemly to send someone like Rudolf Hess on a flight like that secretively to people you weren't even sure who was really there. It just wasn't, and he wouldn't have done it, and that's why he was so angry. Hess's flight was announced to the world by Berlin. The British only admitted to it afterward and in a neutral way. They did not try to make political hay out of it. They only wanted the story to go away. Hess was not seen in public until 1945 at the Nuremberg trial. And once that was over, he was again never seen in public again. I may have dismissed too lightly the pro-peace forces in Britain, but I don't think they were in a position to accomplish anything. Those who believe there was a strong peace lobby say it included Lloyd George, Lord Halifax, Rab Butler, Lord Beaverbrook, Sir Neville Henderson, who was British ambassador to Germany, and Sir Samuel Orr, who was British ambassador to Spain. And I'm not sure how long Lord Halifax was ambassador to the U.S., but this idea that these men were in a peace, were open to peace with Germany, was much disputed by historian Martin Allen, who says that Halifax and Hoare were set up by SO1 to pretend this while really acting as agents for British intelligence. Hess's friend, the Duke of Hamilton, was now an RAF officer, and while he did not want to cooperate in any way in the deception and didn't like what he had learned about it from all appearances, still he was not conspiring to oust Churchill. Hamilton later denied even being a member of the Anglo-German Fellowship, just as he denied meeting Hess at the Berlin Olympics in 1936. But in fact, his own archives betray his membership in the Fellowship in 1936, while there's ample evidence of the meeting in Berlin during the Olympics with Hess. I should also make clear that Hess wrote to his friend, the Duke of Hamilton, and thought he was receiving replies, but actually the mail was intercepted by SO1, and from then on they carried on the correspondence on the Duke of Hamilton's behalf, copying his handwriting and his signature, not necessarily with his knowledge. So the Duke of Hamilton was not as involved as Hess thought in his back and forth communication, although I believe that Albrecht Haushofer did have some meetings with him, but these would have been early on. The later meetings seemed to be just with Samuel Hoare. There were some other meetings by other people, other parts of the German government, reaching out here and there, but this business with the Hess and Haushofer, it had come down to Samuel Hoare. Whether Hitler knew or didn't know in advance that Hess was going to fly, while of great interest, I don't see it's of great importance in the matter of the morality and the meaning of the whole affair. It doesn't change who was responsible not only for starting the war, but for prolonging it, and also for enlarging it. But every account I have read sees the deceit of the British in this instance as wrong, and their treatment of Rudolf Hess as deplorable, yet in the end they come up with their defense, the inevitable defense, and it's always on the same grounds. The one at the end of Myths and Legends of the Second World War by James Hayward is typical, and I'm going to quote it. I'm quoting, "Today, few would disagree that Rudolf Hess was kept far too long in captivity, a hapless pawn in a prolonged game of chess between former allies turned Cold War adversaries. However, it is important to remember that the underlying purpose of the Hess peace mission, the last serious attempt to reach an Anglo-German détente, was in no way humanitarian. Hess was a staunch Nazi, and like Hitler, desired a peace which would allow Germany to continue the war in the East, leaving the Reich free to initiate the Holocaust unhindered. Against this background, it matters little that the original point of the war, the liberation of Poland from foreign occupation, was never achieved." I'm going to repeat that sentence. "Against this background of the Holocaust, it matters little that the original point of the war, the liberation of Poland from foreign occupation, was never achieved. Therefore, it would be quite wrong to conclude that Hess should be admired for his efforts, or that Churchill should be criticized for rejecting his proposals out of hand, rather than putting them before his cabinet or the Commons." Unquote. Those are the hardened attitudes of British apologetics. The Holocaust is brought in to blot out the Allied failures to live up to their stated principles. In my opinion, they remain deceitful and cowardly to this day. That's all for this program. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com. Thank you.